Hi, this is Gordon Deal. The Wall Street Journal This Weekend starts right after this. For most of you, the desire to learn didn't stop after college. That's the motivation behind The Great Courses. The Great Courses features engaging, informative audio and video lectures from some of the top professors and experts in their fields, like Understanding Investments by Connell Fullenkamp, financial economics professor at Duke University. The course is designed to broaden and deepen the knowledge of more experienced investors while introducing the fundamentals of investing to those new to the subject. The Great Courses has been in production for over 20 years, with over 500 courses on many subjects, including science, mathematics, history, art and music, philosophy, and more. Listen to or watch The Great Courses with online downloads and streaming via their apps or on DVDs or CDs at your own pace, and no exams. The Great Courses has a special offer for Wall Street Journal listeners. Order Understanding Investments and get 80% off the original price. But this 80% savings is only available for a limited time. Don't wait. Go to thegreatcourses.com/WSJ. That's thegreatcourses.com/WSJ.
Direct from the newsroom of the Wall Street Journal, the Wall Street Journal This Weekend with Gordon Deal.
Crony capitalists are still in charge. I'm Gordon Deal with Mike Weinstein, who's filling in for Gina Cervetti. Thanks for spending some of your weekend with us. Here's what's coming up during this program.
House Majority Leader Eric Cantor may have suffered a surprise defeat in his GOP primary, but one observer says don't bet that this is a trend.
Moms may shake their heads when dads engage in rough and tumble play with the kids, but guess what? Dads are onto something.
This is the opening weekend of the World Cup in Brazil. The U.S. begins play Monday. Meanwhile, hear the surprising backgrounds of some referees.
And how to go to a rock concert like a rock star.
They used to make their money on record sales. With digitalization, that's kind of gone out the window. And there's had to be these new revenue streams. Artists always really made a lot of money on touring. But now the importance of that has really just kind of amped up, combined with the fact that you're also trying to reach a demographic that increasingly wants these creature comforts.
You should hear the creature comforts that Market Watch reporter Charles Passey recently encountered from the recent governor's ball in New York. He explains later in the hour. So you may have heard that the days of establishment Republicans are numbered after we watched House Majority Leader Eric Cantor of Virginia lose his GOP primary race to an economics professor backed by the Tea Party movement. But Yahoo Finance columnist Rick Newman says crony capitalists have nothing to worry about. They still rule. He joins us on the T-Mobile hotline. Rick, how do you see this?
Part of the analysis of what happened to Eric Cantor is that this was some sort of protest vote against, you know, cozy relationships between legislators and Congress and the business lobby and especially financial firms that give a lot of money to those legislators. So the thinking is that while voters are really fed up and they're just not going to put up with this anymore, and that may have been a factor in the Cantor defeat, but I think this idea that voters are going to somehow revolt and throw out all these crony capitalists or the friends of the crony capitalists is just completely overblown. Crony capitalists basically have an ironclad grip on Washington, and the defeat of one member of Congress, even if it's a high-ranking member of Congress, isn't going to change that.
Yeah, we always say that this could lead to the snowball effect, right? But it never does.
Nope. There is no snowball, and a big part of the reason is that crony capitalism actually works. Money is incredibly important in politics because it helps you get elected. It buys you the media coverage that you need to get on everybody's mind. It helps you block out the message from the other guy. And once you're in Congress, it's almost self-perpetuating because if you have a vote or you have more influence than that over policy and legislation, such as committee chairmen and chairwomen do, it's incredibly important for the business lobbyists to keep you in power if you happen to favor policies that benefit them. And that's the way the system is. So there are enormously powerful interests in Washington that want these people to remain incumbents because they have some control over them, and they are predictable, and they know how they're going to vote, and they know how to use these people to get things done. So there's a lot of money going into the system to make sure that doesn't change. And we had one little election here that sort of slipped through the cracks, but that's not going to happen system-wide.
Did David Bratt play that up, or is this just a matter of him turning out the vote more so than Mr. Cantor?
it's a little bit hard to tell, and everybody wants a sort of simple answer to why this happened. I mean, it appears that Eric Cantor was just complacent. He got too complacent about getting reelected. He took voters for granted, and voters in his district, enough of them felt that he wasn't one of them anymore, and he was not a proper Virginian, and he wasn't really looking out for the district. I mean, he had become a big national name, spending a lot of time, you know, with movers and shakers, probably not in his home district as much as voters felt he needed to be, and that worked against him. So, you know, the fact that he didn't see this coming tells you he was not paying close enough attention to his home voters.
We're speaking with Yahoo Finance columnist Rick Newman. He's got a story about how the crony capitalists rule and Eric Cantor's defeat won't change that. The bought and sold Congress, as it is called. I mean, it'd have to be some radical rules in place to change the culture, correct?
Yeah, that we could change the culture. The sad irony is Congress would have to pass those rules.
And Fox watching the hen house.
Yeah, it's interesting because, I mean, you increasingly hear members of Congress themselves complain about all the fundraising they have to do. And you almost get the feeling that they would, some of them anyway, would feel a sense of relief if the money were somehow taken out of politics or if limits were put on it. The one thing working against that is that the money flow into politics really favors incumbents. So if you stopped the money or slowed the flow of it, you probably would see more challengers getting elected because this huge advantage, the huge fundraising advantage that incumbents have would lessen, and you'd see more upsets such as this. So that's the one thing that basically keeps the rules in place. And meanwhile, we've had two Supreme Court decisions that there have been some limits on fundraising, and we've had two Supreme Court decisions in the last couple of years that have revoked even those limits.
Thanks, Rick. Yahoo Finance columnist Rick Newman, who's based in New York. 12 minutes now after the hour on the Wall Street Journal this weekend. Coming up next, dad's style of play versus mom's style of play on this Father's Day weekend.
We help farmers make the best use of their land, which means healthier crops, higher yields, and less harvesting hours. Which is good news for a growing population and good news for the environment. BASF, the chemical company.
Thanks for spending part of your Father's Day weekend with us. Numerous studies show a correlation between warm, nurturing fathers who play well with preschoolers and children and teens with better self-control and social skills. Who wants to wrestle, right? How are we so magical in our powers? Here's Wall Street Journal columnist Sue Schellenbarger. Sue, it's about time this gets some recognition.
It's been a while coming because much of the early research on child development focused on mothers and what the mother-child bond had impacted kids' development. Now researchers are turning a much bigger lens on fathers' behavior, and they're finding out that dads, through their play and their use of challenging language, also help to instill social and relationship skills later in life.
Interesting, the challenging language. What do you mean by that?
When a father talks with a baby, oftentimes, sometimes this is just because of the roles. It can be the mother, too, if she happens to have been away. But coming home from work, for example, a dad might say, when a child says, you know, I want my binky, the dad will say, why don't you tell me what you want in real words? Well, mom will just often hear just single syllable responses and interpret them right away because perhaps she's been with the child more often. Oh. Again, this is more a function of mom or dad being with the child more often. So dads tend to challenge kids more.
I'm looking at one of these lines that talks about researchers testing new procedures for evaluating the messier ways that dads bond with kids, like rough and tumble play. Explain the role of that.
This is one of the most interesting things. It's fairly easy in the laboratory to see whether a baby is securely bonded with a mother or father. You can do a test that separates them briefly and see how they behave when they're put back together. With fathers, how do you evaluate a dad scuffling around, pillow fighting, wrestling, taking a kid out to explore?
Right.
This tends to be what fathers do more often, and researchers are coming up with some creative ways to try to study that by having dads play and videotape it and coding the behavior or even staging situations in the lab where children are challenged with physical tasks.
We're speaking with Wall Street Journal columnist Sue Schellenbarger. She has a piece about why having a dad matters. So there might be recommendations based on that, for example?
Well, for example, I think what may happen as researchers learn more about the very specific things that dads do, I think it may both help people appreciate what seems like inexplicable behavior by dads who may, you know, roll around with their kids and get them all excited while mom mom's rolling her eyes. There's value in that for a child to learn how to moderate their emotions in a high-intensity situation, how to keep their emotions under control, how to read other people's desires, and it really does instill a kind of social skill and self-regulation that's very special, and it is unique to dad or to the parent who does the rough and tumble play.
I guess we've always sort of felt, right, in broken families, we point to the missing father, for example, but this sort of seems to try to define the role more specifically for dad in the family?
It does. It defines the role of different types of parents. Every child needs that secure bond with a parent, we all know that, who is devoted to them. But the child also needs, on the other end, someone who is challenging them to explore, providing a secure base. And one study of fathers' desires in playing with their kids showed that fathers walk a fine line between risk and safety, and they will push their child into a situation where maybe the kid will get a minor injury. And they don't see that as necessarily bad. That teaches a child to kind of roll with the punches and maybe make good judgments in the future and set good limits for him or herself. So there is room for two kinds of personalities, really, in raising a child. And researchers in studying fathers are gaining a new appreciation of the play dimension.
Thanks, Sue. It's Wall Street Journal columnist Sue Schellenbarger. So researchers studying the father's role here look at how they act during rough and tumble play. So in Sue's piece, she lists some of the positive signs. One, father is immersed in the game emotionally, smiling and laughing. Father shows spontaneity, creativity, or silliness. Father is good-natured about losing with no signs of ego. Mike Weinstein, you're smiling. You got a little rough and tumble in your house growing up?
Not growing up, but with my kids, yes.
I mean, as your kids grew up, yeah.
Yes.
So you did what? Your go-to game during cabin fever times was what?
I would sit with my legs spread in front of me, and my kids would come running across the room and could do like a flying body press into my chest and see if they could knock me over. And as they got bigger, it got easier and harder on me to stay upright.
Right.
But it was just a nice little, you know, bashing of the chest, almost like a
right.
Thumping.
Right, and you get a good ab workout also.
Without a doubt.
Right, right. Try not to fall over on your back.
And springing back up,
right?
Exactly.
Very good. I'm more of a thrower.
Oh, okay.
Like, we use the master bed sometimes as a wrestling ring, and, you know, I'm the giant wrestler, they're the small ones, and I toss them onto, like, the pile of pillows as they screech in delight. And in the pool, too.
Right.
You know, you support them by the butt and then launch them, you know, shoulder high. That's kinda...
Do we do this with mom in the room, or?
See, the thing about mom is that she lacks the spontaneity. She worries about the bedpost scratching the wall right. as the kids crash into the bed and the bed slides across the wood floor. Yeah, that's her big concern.
They really put a damper on things.
Yeah, you know, party poopers. It's 20 minutes now after the hour on the Wall Street Journal this weekend. Here is Mike Weinstein.
Gordon, with so many changes happening in the healthcare sector, a new strategy is being employed. It's called patient engagement and involves people being more proactive with their preventative care and following doctors' orders. But as the Journal's Laura Landrieu explains, medical professionals cannot do this alone.
Unless they can get the patients to stick to their regimens and get involved in their care and do the things that they have to do to take care of themselves, that none of this is going to work.
A big help nowadays is that patients have more access to their medical records online than ever before. Which are the best jobs for women in the U.S.? CareerCast is out with its list with criteria including a competitive salary, positive hiring outlook, as well as a high number of women in the field. Tony Lee of CareerCast tells us about the number one position, computer systems analyst.
Women had a really hard time breaking in, but now women make up about 40% of all the computer systems analysts out there. So it's a job where there's huge hiring demand, salaries really soaring, so it's a great fit for women who have that type of background.
That might be a bit of a surprise for some to hear, but another top job is no shocker. It's been on the list for a while. Dental hygienist. Other jobs with bright prospects include public relations managers and physical therapists. Are you nearing retirement age, or are you already there? If the answer to either question is yes, then you know that managing your nest egg when it comes to withdrawals can be as complicated as building it in the first place. Walter Updegrave of the soon-to-be-launched website Real Deal Retirement explains the balancing act that many must undertake.
You want the money to last very long, but you don't want to spend so little that very late in life, when you may not be able to enjoy your money as much, you have a whole lot left.
And finally, Gordon, it was 20 years ago this week that we all watched the slow speed chase of O.J. Simpson and his white Ford Bronco. But if that happened today, it might be harder to pick out the vehicle. White remains the most popular color of autos in the U.S. for the 8th straight year, according to Exalta Coating Systems. By the way, back in 94, the most popular color was green. Red was number 2 and white came in 3rd.
Oh, how about that?
Well, I just feel we seem to have lost all creativity sometimes, right? Even mine. I have a 2004 Toyota Camry. It's gray.
Right.
There was a while where it just seemed like everything was gray. Not a lot of imagination.
No, I guess not. But you see the occasional orange or, you know, teal-colored car coming down the road, but not too many of those.
Those are the artists.
Right.
You can always spot them a mile away. Thanks, Mike. 23 minutes now after the hour on the Wall Street Journal This Weekend. America was built by innovators and dreamers like you. To celebrate, LegalZoom dedicated this month to innovation by making it easy for you to file trademark or copyright applications, incorporate your business, or form an LLC. Call or visit LegalZoom.com. They'll provide the personal attention you need and help take care of all the details. For a limited time, get a special price on trademark and copyright applications by using the referral code WSJ at checkout. LegalZoom provides legal help through independent attorneys and self-help, but they're not a law firm.
Leaving the country on business takes a lot of planning. Bringing your data plan doesn't. With T-Mobile's Simple Choice for Business plan, you'll get unlimited data in over 100 countries automatically. There's no changing plans and no extra charges. Just get off the plane and go. Only at T-Mobile.
Qualifying service and capable device required. Standard speeds approximately 128 kilobytes per second. No tethering. See T-Mobile.com for full feature terms and included destinations.
Thanks for being with us on this Father's Day weekend. Let's talk gadgets. How about something that nags you like your mother about the sun? Wall Street Journal personal technology writer Joanna Stern is here with a review of a wearable device called the Netatmo June, which monitors the sun's rays. Joanna, how's it work?
It is a bracelet that's actually aimed at women. It really looks like a piece of jewelry. And inside the bracelet, it has a UV tracker. And so that pairs with your phone. The bracelet pairs with your phone via Bluetooth. And as it's sitting in the sun and as it gets UV data and as it thinks it's getting warmer, it provides or it sends notifications to your phone that tell you to put on SPF, to put on a hat, to put on sunscreen, and also if you've gotten your maximum daily sun dosage.
So is it actually picking up rays from the sun, or is it going off some sort of local weather forecast and doing it that way?
No, it's picking up rays right from the sun. It's got a UV tracker right in the top of the device. And like I said, what's really interesting about this device is it's really gadgets disguised as jewelry or jewelry disguised as gadgets, depending on which way you want to look at it. And you really don't see that there's any type of tech in here. There's no blinking lights. There's no screens. There's no buttons. Just that little UV tracker at the top sits there. It has a little bit of little holes in it. But you really wouldn't have any idea that this was a gadget.
How did you find it performed?
That's where things got a little shaky. You know, I was skeptical of the idea that I have to wear something to tell me to get out of the sun. I kind of know that, right? But I actually found that it provided interesting information about when I didn't know I was getting so much sun. Mm. So I had lunch the other day in San Francisco. It was cold out. I definitely didn't think the UV rating was that high. It turned out to be 6, and that it told me to put on SPF 15. So it made me more aware of the sun I'm getting in my everyday life. That said, that was only when the bracelet actually worked, and that was a problem I had throughout the week. The bracelet just had a lot of technical problems.
We're speaking with Wall Street Journal personal technology writer Joanna Stern. She's got a story about the Netatmo June, which is a wearable device that tracks your exposure to the sun. What's it cost?
Cost $99.
Okay.
Yeah. And, you know, that's where I actually net out at the end is that I don't think this is worth $99 right now, at least not with the technical problems that it has. Mm-hmm. I do think, though, that the idea of having UV tracking on our gadgets and perhaps in the future on the bracelets and the wearables that we're already starting to wear, the fitness bracelets, I think that's very valuable. And I think as a single-purpose device right now, $99, it doesn't cut it, like I said, especially for the problems that I had with this thing.
So how are you getting the information? Via text from the app itself? Or did you have to check the app to see? Or did you get pings? Or what happened?
Yeah. It works just like a regular push notification on the iPhone. You get a notification every couple 15 minutes or so, depending on how the UV rating is changing, depending on how much sunscreen you've put on. I mean, that's a little bit of a flaw in the system. You don't actually tell it when you put on sunscreen.
Oh, okay.
So it kind of reminds you to keep putting on sunscreen.
Thanks, Joanna. Wall Street Journal personal technology writer Joanna Stern. 30 minutes now after the hour on the Wall Street Journal This Weekend.
When I was pregnant, I got more advice than I knew what to do with. What I needed was information I could trust on how to take care of me and my baby. Luckily, United Healthcare has a simple program that helps moms stay on track with their doctors and get the right care and guidance before and after the baby is born. Simple is good right now.
Innovations that work for you. That's health in numbers. United Healthcare.
Thanks for spending part of your Father's Day weekend with us. That's right, I said weekend. We're not limited to just Sundays anymore. It's Father's Day weekend. Gordon Deal with Mike Weinstein is filling in for Gina Cervetti. Coming up this half hour, rock concerts, Scotch whiskey, and soccer. Interesting piece on World Cup referees and what they do for full-time work. We'll have that report in about 20 minutes. Well, a new generation of fathers with corporate jobs is wading into the debate about balancing work and family. As you know, it's a conversation long dominated by working women. Wall Street Journal reporter Lauren Weber says more working fathers are taking a shot at having it all. Lauren, what's new here?
Well, it turns out that men are really struggling with this issue. I think we've known that actually for a while. What's interesting, I think, now is that fathers are more comfortable speaking up, both publicly and like in the media and also at work, about the fact that they're having to juggle a lot and they're having a hard time doing it. And I think they're looking for employers to respond to that.
Old generation of dads said, this is my work. I'm dedicated to it. Perhaps, you know, the wife is taking care of things at home, but the new generation of dads thinks differently?
They not only think differently, but their life realities are very different. For the most part, their wives are working. In many cases, their wives have more education than they do, yeah. And in many cases, also more earning power. So families are finding that for purely practical reasons, it makes more sense for the man to sacrifice for his wife's career. That means he might be the one who's responsible for picking up a sick kid at school or handling morning drop-offs at daycare, that kind of thing. So, you know, it's not only that fathers' own expectations about fatherhood have changed. They want to be more involved than their own dads perhaps were. But it's also that families can't function now without them making some sacrifices on the work front as well.
Interesting. What kind of stats do we have here, Lauren?
Well, there's a lot of information out there and a lot of surveys being done on working parents in general and fathers specifically. Among other things, the Families and Work Institute, which does a lot of research on families and work, has found that men actually claim that they have more work-life conflict than women do. That number kind of reversed in 1997. Before that, it was women who were reporting higher levels of work-family conflict. In 1997, it switched and it became men saying that they have more. And in 2008, the last time that the survey was done, 60% of fathers said that they were struggling with that issue versus 47% of mothers. Now, one interesting explanation for that is partly about the workplace, and it's that managers understand that women have these issues and struggles and are probably much more understanding of those dual commitments and dual roles. They're a lot less willing to, or they make more assumptions perhaps about fathers not having to, you know, be available for their kids. And so they may be making fewer concessions to them or less understanding about requests for flexibility and that type of thing.
We're speaking with Wall Street Journal reporter Lauren Weber about dads balancing work and family. I wonder what kind of role telecommuting has had in that it seems more people are able to work from home. Dads, for example, maybe they're more willing to take, you know, traditional role with childcare because they can work from home.
Yeah, and there's a lot of research that shows that men are more likely to take advantage of telecommuting arrangements than women are. But that doesn't necessarily mean they're doing more at home. And in some cases, it is. And I spoke to an interesting executive from Accenture whose wife was in medical school. And because of her work obligations, they had to move out of New York, where they were living at the time. And he took on a different role at the company and became a work-from-home employee. All of his work is done remotely. And they have a nanny, so, you know, he's not responsible for the childcare, but he's also the one who's there when the nanny arrives in the morning and there when she leaves at the end of the day. So he has managed to, you know, use technology and telecommuting to make it work, being a much more involved dad given his wife's schedule.
All right. Thanks, Lauren. Wall Street Journal reporter Lauren Weber. I get to spend a lot of time with my kids because of the hours I work. I was a horrible, horrible multitasker. I'm better now. Better now. I've learned along the way. Old dog learns new tricks. 21 minutes in front of the hour now on the Wall Street Journal this weekend. Coming up next, how to go to a rock show and be treated like a rock star. Hey, glad you're with us. So rock concerts these days are not like the ones we attended growing up. There's more of a we'll call it a highbrow element today at some of these shows. Market Watch reporter Charles Pazzi has tips on how to attend a rock show like a rock star. Charles, what's been your recent experience?
All the major rock festivals are offering VIP packages. I was just at Governor's Ball in New York City, and it ranged from a $215 VIP ticket, which basically got you, you know, a better sight lines and a little more privacy, to a $30,000 cabana with gourmet catered meals, air-conditioned restrooms, you name it. There was pretty much everything thrown that way at you for $30,000. So, yeah, there's a lot of different things happening.
You know what, Charles? This sounds like what's happening at a lot of professional sports venues, right? NFL stadiums, NBA stadiums?
It is absolutely what's happening at a lot of professional sports venues. I mean, it's basically taking a playbook. In some ways, they've taken the sports playbook and really just applied it to rock and roll. There's a couple of things that are going on. I don't want to speak to the economics of the sports teams, but the music business, they've really had to embrace this model. I mean, the entire setup for the music industry has changed. They used to make their money on record sales. With digitalization, that's kind of gone out the window. And there's had to be these new revenue streams. Artists always really made a lot of money on touring, but now the importance of that has really just kind of amped up, combined with the fact that you're also trying to reach a demographic that increasingly wants these creature comforts. I mean, I talked to a festival goer at Governor's Ball this past weekend, and he said, you know, I'm getting old. I'm in my 30s. I can't sit on the lawn anymore. So, there's a real different dynamic at play. And frankly, the music business is really looking at this revenue stream to make ends meet.
Wow. Which artists? Do we know who's spoken out on this?
The big one, this, I don't know if they refuse it at every given turn, but the one that was really kind of speaking about it recently was Arcade Fire was against this. There have been other artists in the past. I don't want to say that Springsteen has never done it. Probably by now he has, for all I know, but I mean, he's been somebody in the past who's generally taken kind of a dim view on VIP seating. I mean, I think any artist you can imagine that really cultivates a of the people, for the people kind of stance is going to be less inclined to go the VIP route. The problem for artists is when they're paying a group event like a festival, it's a little less out of their control. So if the festival wants to do it, I suppose the artist could turn down playing the festival altogether. But these days, if you want to be a rock star, you got to play the festival circuit.
We're speaking with Market Watch reporter Charles Pazzi. He's got a piece about how to go to a rock show like a rock star. This $30,000 package you were talking about at the Governor's Ball, the air-conditioned restrooms, really?
Yeah, absolutely. Actually, you could get that for the $215 VIP seat. Let me tell you, that you know, porta-potties are a fact of life in rock festivals, and I have to say, they are. If there was one thing that I would say was appealing about any kind of VIP seat, it's the idea of an air-conditioned restroom, or it's just an idea of avoiding the porta-potty. But, you know, the people who spent $30,000 for a cabana, we should be clear, that was good for an admission for up to 16 people for all 3 days. So if you do the math, it isn't quite as dramatic as the $30,000 price tag might suggest.
Thanks, Charles. Market Watch reporter Charles Pazzi, who's based in New York. 15 minutes now before the hour on the Wall Street Journal This Weekend. Coming up next, Scotch whiskey. A little chat with a brand ambassador.
We help farmers make the best use of their land, which means healthier crops, higher yields, and less harvesting hours, which is good news for a growing population and good news for the environment. BASF, the chemical company.
Thanks for being with us. Need a last-minute gift idea for Dad? How about a little booze, specifically Scotch whiskey without the E? Yeah, W-H-I-S-K-Y for the Scots. We're joined now by David Laird, brand ambassador for Balvenie Scotch. David, sell it.
I think Scotch whiskey is probably the perfect gift, I think, for Father's Day. Because for me, Father's Day is always about spending time with Dad, and nothing like a good single malt to actually make you slow down and appreciate what's going on and just spend a little time sharing a dram together. So it's a nice Balvenie is definitely going to make you do that.
All right. And explain what we should look for, say, on the label here, because I don't know a lick about Scotch whiskey. For example, a single malt versus blended.
Is very good at giving you a lot of information on their labels. And a lot of it's going to tell you whereabouts in Scotland it's from, which distillery it comes from, like the Balvenie distillery. It's going to tell you it comes from up in Speyside. And this bit of information will give you an idea of what kind of flavor profile you're looking for. But it also tells you what age the whiskey is, and it'll also tell you what kind of cask they used as well. So, like our 21-year-old was aged in American oak, and then it moved to a cask that used to hold wine. These casks are anywhere from 30 to 40 years old, so there's a lot of information comes through there. But people are very knowledgeable now, so if you go to a nice liquor store or you go online research, you'll get a lot of information about how to find that perfect whiskey and what flavor you're looking for.
I don't understand single malt, say, versus double malt versus blended. What does all that mean?
Well, a single malt is really just the whiskey from one distillery. So when you're drinking a Balvenie single malt, you're really getting that whiskey from that one single Balvenie distillery. And it means you actually get the flavor and the personality of the people working there is going to come through in that whiskey. And if you like that flavor profile that we're making there, it means you can try the other different variants and different ages we have because you know that flavor profile that's going to come through.
Interesting.
When you're making a blended whiskey, you're actually taking about maybe 20 to 30 different single malts from all over the country. And you're bringing them together, and you're going to add that to grain whiskey and produce a whiskey that's very hard to make in a very consistent manner. And you're getting this whiskey that's got a lot of flavors from all over the country. So it's definitely a different style. One's not better than the other. It's just a completely different way of making whiskey there.
We're speaking with David Laird, brand ambassador for Balvenie brand Scotch whiskey. Tell me how you sell Scotch whiskey versus what the Irish make.
We're making a slightly different product in Scotland. We can only use barley when we make our whiskey. And one of the main differences between Scotch and Irish is we double distill our whiskey mostly. So double distilling our whiskey is going to help keep a little bit more of the bigger note flavors in our whiskey. So you get a little bit more depth of flavor, maybe more layers of flavor coming through in Scotch. The Irish whiskey, they're going to be triple distilling a lot of the time, and that's going to give it a much smoother tasting whiskey. Again, just different styles of whiskey, and everybody has their favorite. And it's very unusual for a whiskey drinker to only like one style of whiskey. They tend to like a lot of different whiskeys, and they'll have their favorite that they always come back to.
Everybody has their favorite. David Laird, brand ambassador for Balvenie Scotch. It's 8 minutes now before the hour on the Wall Street Journal this weekend. Once again, here's Mike Weinstein.
Gordon, do you speak to your children about your job? Many people believe that work and home life should remain mutually exclusive, but there can be benefits to discussing office issues around the dinner table. As Emma Johnson of MarketWatch advises, this could be especially beneficial for moms.
This is a really positive, awesome part of who you are as a woman, as a mother. Show them that part of yourself. Be a great role model for why it's important to work, about positive messages about business and finance and career.
Sharing your professional accomplishments can help encourage your kids to aspire to be successful both professionally and personally. Johnson added that it's our duty to send our children out into the world well-equipped with concrete business acumen and a positive attitude about earning a living. The real estate blog Movoto is out with its list of most stressed out states in the U.S. Florida is number one. High numbers of people without health insurance, as well as housing expenses and long hours or long work week hours, were all factors. Second on the list was Georgia, then New Jersey, and then California. Want to go where there is the least amount of stress? Move to North Dakota. And when you are looking to sell your home, keep in mind the value of hardwood floors as you prepare to list. Data from Realtor.com suggests that buyers prefer wood over wall-to-wall carpeting. Amy Hoke of MarketWatch explains some of the reasons.
It's very neutral. It also offers kind of a clean look that people like. And for people with allergies, it can be huge because carpets will attract more allergens.
And since many buyers might be willing to bypass your home if they see any carpeting, you may want to give some thought to ripping it out before the open houses begin. Another big upside to using hardwood floors is that they can be sanded and refinished a number of times, unlike other artificial flooring varieties. You may be able to list at a higher asking price, and when you combine that with the potential bidding war, it makes it clearly worth the investment. Finally, Gordon, would you drink milk from a camel? If so, you are not alone. California-based Desert Farms has launched a line of products, including milk from the humped animals, touting its health benefits, including that it is richer, more filling, and more easily digested than the milk of, say, cows or goats. It's being sold at 40 Whole Foods stores throughout California. A pint of camel milk, though, will set you back
$18. $18?
For a pint.
By the way, you asked the question, would I drink milk from a camel? If I said yes or no, am I not alone? I guess I would say no.
No, because many people in California are apparently paying $18 for a pint.
Yeah. Holy smokes. My chiropractor friend says humans are the only animals that drink the milk of other animals.
Traveling overseas for business comes with a checklist of things to worry about. But with T-Mobile, you can take getting international data off that list. Because with a simple choice for business plan, unlimited data in over 100 countries is automatically included at no extra charge. Only at T-Mobile.
Qualifying service and capable device required. Standard speeds approximately 128 kilobytes per second. No tethering. See T-Mobile.com for full feature terms and included destinations.
So the World Cup, right, uses a more democratic than meritocratic process for choosing refs. And while the World Cup's 32 teams must play their way into the tournament through a two-year qualifying process, FIFA, the sport's governing body, pulls referees from more than 40 countries out of a sense of fairness to all of its member associations, sometimes with these results.
More, it's played into the box. Oh, and that's it.
That's a flop.
It was a flop, I thought, too.
Flop.
Penalty. He called
a
penalty.
Are you kidding me or something?
A penalty and a yellow card as well.
That's an absolute disgrace.
Tommy Smith not happy with the ref's call, Brazil's game against Croatia. It's a contrast from the meritocracy that determines who officiates the postseason for major U.S. sports. Meanwhile, outside of England, soccer refereeing is the hobby of men who tend to hold down day jobs. Italian referee Nicola Rizzoli is an architect. Peter O'Leary of New Zealand, high school science teacher. And Ericsson of Sweden just happens to be independently wealthy. For Mike Weinstein, I'm Gordon Deal. Thanks for listening to the Wall Street Journal This Weekend.